My arm felt as if, having been burned before, it was now being boiled. A flare of light then flashed up. Orlick. Whom I had looked for, I don't know. I had not looked for him. I made out I was fastened to a stout perpendicular ladder, a fixture to the wall leading to the loft.
Down by me! Let me go!
I'll let you go. To the stars. All in good time.
Why have you lured me in here?
Because I mean to do it all myself. One keeps a secret better than two. Do you know where you saw this gun afore? Speak, Wolf!
At Miss Havisham's.
You cost me that place, you did. You did! And that would be enough without more. How dared you come between me and a young woman I liked?
When?
When didn't you? It was you who always give old Orlick a bad name to Biddy. What was it you said to her? You'll take any pains and spend any money to drive me out of this country.
What are you going to do to me?
I'm going to have your life. You goes out of old Orlick's way this present night, he'll have no more on you. You're dead. Don't look round. There's no escape. I won't have a bone of you left on earth. I'll put your body in the kiln and let people suppose what they may of you. I shall never know nothing. Wolf! Old Orlick's gonna tell you something. It was you as did for your shrew sister.
You!
I come up from behind her like on you tonight. I give it her. But it weren't old Orlick as did it. It was you. You was favoured and he was bullied and beat. You done it. No, you pays for it. Who was the someone who arrived when your uncle arrived at Garden Court? Eh? I've took up with new companions and new masters. Some of them writes my letters when I want some rope, Wolf. They write 50 hands.
Cumbersome?
His business was the swindling. Handwriting, forging.
Then I like sneaking you as writes only one. I've had a firm mind and a firm will to have your life since you was down here at your sister's burying. And I've looked after you to know your ins and outs, for I says somehow or other, I'll have him. What? When I looks for you, I finds your Uncle Provis. Eh? But when old Orlick come for to hear that your Uncle Provis had most like wore the leg iron what old Orlick had picked up, filed asunder on these very meshes ever so many year ago, and what he kept by him till he dropped your sister with it. Like a bullock. As he means to drop you. Hey! Yeah, the burnt child dreads the fire. Old Orlick knowed you was burned. When old Orlick come to hear you was smuggling your Uncle Provis away, he knowed he'd have got you. You'd come tonight. Now, I'll tell you something more, Wolf, and this ends the talking. There's them that can't and that won't have Magwitch. I knows the name. Won't have Magwitch alive in the same land with them. Perhaps it's them that writes with 50 hands. And that's not like sneaking you, as writes but one. Beware, Compasson, Magwitch, and the gallows.
He stooped suddenly, drunkenly, and I saw in his hands a stone hammer with a long, heavy handle.
Help! Help!
Handel?
Herbert?
I think he's all right.
But ain't he just pale, though?
How did...
Softly, gently, dear Handel. Don't be too eager.
Where's Orlick?
Escaped.
Startled.
Remember what he's going to assist us in, and be calm.
Who's this boy?
I work for Mr. Trabb, the outfitter.
He led us here.
The time's not gone by, has it, Herbert?
No, it's still Sunday night.
Gently they rebound my arm and explained everything. Startop had found the real letter. In my hurry, I must have dropped it. Its tone was so different to the one I'd left for Herbert. They both took a postchaise here, found Trab's boy lounging outside the Blue Boar, and hurried for the sluice house to hear my cries.
We must notify a magistrate.
No, no. Any delay, Herbert, might be fatal to Provis. No, no. We must return to Garden Court now. At Garden Court, I was kept very quiet, my arm constantly dressed and given cooling drinks. But whenever I slept, I was in the nightmare of the sluice house. This was combined with the fear of falling really ill and being unfitted for the adventure ahead. But as no ill news came, I increasingly found rest. Wednesday morning finally dawned. The coming sun, a marsh of fire on the horizon.
When the tide turns at 9 o'clock, look out for us and stand ready, you over there at Mill Pond Bank.
It was one of those days when it is summer in the light and winter in the shade. Of all my worldly possessions, I took no more than the few necessaries that filled my bag. The tide, beginning to run down at 9 and being with us till 3, we intended to run with it, and then, when it turned, row against it till dark. By then we would be below Gravesend, and somewhere solitary could be found for the night. On Thursday morning we would meet the Hamburg steamer. The moving river freshened me with new hope. I felt mortified to be of so little use in the boat, but there were few better oarsmen than my two friends, and they rowed with a steady stroke that was to last all day.
Mill Pond Bank.
Is he there?
Not yet.
He wasn't to come down till he saw us.
There he is. Easy, Herbert.
Dear boy. Faithful, dear boy. Well done. Thank you. Thank you.
At the stairs, I'd looked warily for any sign of our being suspected, and seeing none. Now, among the clanging shipbuilders' yards, we were not followed.
If you know, dear boy, what it is to sit here, along with my dear boy, and have my smoke, after having been day by day in four walls, you'd envy me.
I think I know the delights of freedom.
Not equal to me. But I ain't a-going to be low.
If all goes well, you'll be perfectly free and safe again within a few hours.
Well, I hope so.
But for your face, I should think you were a little despondent.
Not a bit on it, dear boy. It comes of flowing on so quiet. And it had a rippling in the boat's head, making a sort of a Sunday tune. Maybe I'm growing a trifle old, besides.
The tide ran strong, and I took care to lose none of it. It was yet with us when we were off Gravesend. By dint of this, a quarter of an hour's rest proved all our oarsmen wanted. Ashore, we ate and drank what we had with us, and looked about. It was like my own marsh country. Flat and monotonous, and with a dim horizon. Then the tide turned, but Herbert and Startop persevered and rowed and rowed and rowed until the red sun went down. Night was falling fast. It was very cold, and a collier coming by us with her galley fire smoking and flaring looked like a comfortable home.
What was that?
At this dismal time, we were all possessed by the idea that we were followed.
I think it's a boat.
At length, we saw a light and a roof, a public house alongside a little causeway. There, gratefully, we found two double-bedded rooms, eggs and bacon to eat, various liquors to drink, and by a good fire in the kitchen, a grizzled male creature, Jack, slimy and smeary and wearing a bloated pair of boots, relics he'd taken off a drowned seaman washed ashore.
Hey, you have seen a four-odd galley going up with the tide and two sitters?
No.
Nah, they put him with a stone two-gallon jar for some beer. I'd have been glad to poison the beer myself or put some rattling physic in it.
He thinks they was, but they wasn't.
I know what I thinks.
You thinks they was custom house?
I do.
Then you're wrong, Jack. Did you see their buttons? What'd you make out they done with them?
Swallowed them. Took them overboard so's no one sees them. A four and two sitters don't go hanging and hovering up with one tide and down with another, and both with and against another, without there being custom house at the bottom of it.
This dialogue made us all uneasy, and for the most part destroyed my sleep. We had decided to stay near the house until close to the steamer's time. The sign of the house, creaking and banging, woke me early, and rising softly not to wake my charge, I looked out of the window. Two men were looking into our hold-up boat. Then, looking at nothing else, they passed beneath the window and struck out across the marsh towards the Nore.
You were all too fast asleep for me to disturb you.
Very likely they are from the custom house, and they've no thought of us.
Nevertheless, we remain hidden till we see the steamer smoke. Then we get in the track of it.
At what hour, my dear boy?
1 o'clock.
But it was 1:30 before we saw her smoke. Then, as we left the shore, I saw a four-oared galley shoot out from under the bank a little way ahead of us and row out into the same track. By now, the steamer was visible, coming hard on.
Keep before the tide, Herbert. Sit quite still.
Trust to me, dear boy.
Meanwhile, the galley, which was very skillfully handled, had crossed us and fallen alongside. Leaving just enough room for the play of the oars, she kept alongside, drifting when we drifted and pulling a stroke or two when we pulled. Of the two sitters, one held the rudder lines and looked at us attentively, as did all the rowers. The other sitter was wrapped up, much as Provis was, and seemed to shrink and whisper some instruction to the steerer as he looked at us. Not a word was spoken in either boat. Then, when her shadow was absolutely upon us...
You have a returned transport there. That's the man wrapped in the cloak. His name is Abel Magwitch, otherwise Provis. I apprehend that man and call upon him to surrender and you to assist.
At the same moment, you ran the galley aboard of us. The steersman of the galley grabbed Magwitch's shoulder and both boats swung round and round with the force of the tide. Then I saw Magwitch start up and pull the cloak from the shrinking sitter in the galley. It was Compson. Still in the same moment, I saw his face tilt backward with a white terror on it that I shall never forget, and heard a great cry on board the steamer and a loud splash in the water, and felt the boat sink from under me. It was but for an instant that I seemed to struggle with 1,000 mill wheels and 1,000 flashes of light. That instant passed. I was taken aboard the galley. Herbert was there, and Startop. But the two convicts were gone. At first, I could not distinguish sky from water, shore from shore. But soon the galley was righted with great speed, and every man looked silently and eagerly at the water astern. Presently, a dark object bore towards us on the tide. No one spoke. As it came nearer, I saw it to be Magwitch, swimming, but not freely. He was taken on board, and instantly manacled at the wrists and ankles. Please, don't!
Of the other body, no sign whatsoever. The galley was kept steady, and the silent, eager lookout resumed long after the water was still again. At the inn, we were received with no little surprise and allowed to get some comforts for my charge.
Is that better?
Thank you, Pip's comrade. I this chest, that were against the side of the galley. Pip, my dear boy, come close. I weren't escaping. That villain, Coppison, he went back. We went in. We was locked like chains. He was a-struggling, but I got off. I swam away. It were him coming back, took me in.
The officer gives the same account. We have permission to get you clean clothes.
My pocketbook?
The officer has it.
You going to stay with me, dear boy?
Yes, I'll be with you. When the tide turned, Magwitch was carried down to the galley and put on board, and I took my place by his side, for that was my place henceforth while he lived. My repugnance had all melted away, and in the hunted, wounded, shackled creature who held my hand in his, I only saw a man who had felt affectionately, generously towards me with great constancy through a series of years. I only saw in him a much better man than I had been to Joe. I wish you hadn't come home for my sake.
Dear boy, I'm quite content to take my chance. I've seen my boy, and he can be a gentleman without me. Look here, dear boy. It's best a gentleman should not be known to belong to me now. Only come to see me as if you come by chance, with Wemmick.
I will never stir from your side when I am suffered to be near you. Please God, I will be as true to you as you have been to me.
The sole defense is to admit nothing. Until there is a witness, we admit nothing.
The sole witness may be drowned.
If the witness is there is no power on earth can prevent the case going against us. If the witness is there, it will be over in 5 minutes.
I am desirous, sir, that Mr. Magwitch should be kept in ignorance of the total loss of his wealth,
which you let slip through your fingers to be forfeited to the crown. But we must memorialize it by and by and try at all events for some of it.
I am resolved never to attempt any claim on him. Compson's body was found, and after 3 days' delay, during which a witness from the prison ship was produced in his stead, Magwitch was committed for trial at the next sessions a month hence.
We shall lose a fine opportunity if I put off going to Cairo. I'm very much afraid I must go, Handel, when you need me most.
Herbert, I shall always need you, because I'll always love you. But my need is no greater now than at any other time.
You will be so lonely.
I don't have time to think of that. I'm with him always to the full extent of the time allowed, and when I come away, my thoughts are still with him.
My dear fellow, have you thought of your future? In this branch house of ours, Handel, we must have...
A clerk?
Who could expand, as a clerk of your acquaintance has, into a partner. In short, dear boy, will you come to us?
Thank you both. But I can't be sure of joining you yet. But if you thought, Herbert, that you could, without doing injury to your business, leave the question open for a little while...
For any while? 6 months? A year?
No, 2 or 3 months at the most.
Yes. This gives me the courage to tell you truly now. I must go away at the end of the week.
And Clara?
The dear little thing holds dutifully to her father as long as he lasts. But that won't be for long. And then I shall come back for the dear little thing, and we will walk quietly into the nearest church. Remember, she comes of no family. Yet what a fortune for the son of my mother.
On the Saturday in that same week, I indeed took leave of Herbert, and returned to my lonely home, if it deserved the name, for it was now no home to me, I had no home anywhere.
Mr. Wemmick!
I've come, Mr. Pip, in my private and personal capacity.
Come in! Will you take a glass of grog before you return to Woolworth?
Obliged. I wish to explain my note concerning the late Compeyson. It was from talk of some of his people in trouble that I heard what I did. I kept my ears open until I heard he was absent, and I thought that would be the best time for making the attempt. I can only suppose now that it was part of his policy, as a very clever man, always to deceive his own instruments. You don't blame me, I hope, Mr. Pip. I'm sure I tried to serve you with all my heart.
I am as sure of that, Mr. Wemmick, as you can be, and I thank you most earnestly for all your interest and friendship.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a bad job. Oh, thank you. And I assure you, I haven't been so cut up for a long time. What I look at is the sacrifice of so much portable property. Oh, dear me.
What I think of, Mr. Wemmick, is the poor owner of the property.
Oh, yes.
Your health.
Oh. What do you think of my meaning to take a holiday on Monday, Mr. Pip?
Well, I suppose you've not done such a thing these 12 months.
12 years, more likely. More than that, I'm going to take a walk. And I'm going to ask you to take a walk with me. Yeah, I know your engagements, and I know you are out of sorts, Mr. Pip, but if you could oblige me, I should take it as a kindness. Tent a long walk, and it's an early one, so it might occupy you, including breakfast, from 8 to 12. Couldn't you stretch a point and manage it?
I'll be pleased to.
Punctual to my appointment, I rang at the castle on the Monday morning. Wemmick emerged directly, tighter than usual and having a sleeker hat on, together with a fishing rod.
We're not going fishing.
No, but I like to walk with one.
And we made our way to Camberwell.
Hello! Here's a church. Let's go in. Hello! Here's a couple of pairs of gloves in my pocket. Let's put them on.
As the gloves were white kid, and as the postbox was widened to its utmost extent, I began to have my strong suspicions. These were strengthened into certainty when I beheld the aged enter at a side door escorting a lady.
Hello, here's Miss Skiffins. Let's have a wedding.
And we did. At the fatal rails, I acted as best man, while a little limp pew-opener in a soft baby's bonnet made a feint of being the bosom friend of Miss Skiffins. The aged, giving away the bride, heard nothing.
Who giveth this woman to be married to this man? Who giveth this woman...
Now, aged P, you know, who giveth?
I do. All right, John, all right, my boy.
Good heaven.
Then to an excellent breakfast at a pleasant little tavern, where I drank to the new couple, the aged, the castle, the bride, and above all, drank to Wemmick.
Oh, bravo.
I wish you all joy. All joy, Mr. Wemmick. She's a fine lady.
Thank you. Now, I say, Mr. Pip, this is altogether a Woolworth sentiment, please. After what you let out the other day, Mr. Jaggers may as well not know it. He might think my brain was softening. Oh.
He had broken two ribs, and they had wounded one of his lungs. Therefore he spoke so low as to be scarcely audible, though never to complain. In the infirmary, he being too ill to remain in the common prison, he gradually wasted and became weaker and weaker. The trial was very short and very clear. Such things as could be said for him were said, but nothing could unsay the fact that he had returned. It was impossible to do otherwise than find him guilty. At that time, it was the custom to devote the concluding day to the passing of sentences and to make a finishing effect with the sentence of death. I could scarcely believe, even as I write now, that I saw 32 men and women put before the judge to receive that sentence together. Foremost among them was he, seated, that he might get breath enough to keep life in him.
Of all you wretched creatures now before me, whom I must single out for special address, is the one who, almost from his infancy, has been an offender against the law. One who, after repeated imprisonments and punishments, had been exiled for a term of years. But, in a fatal moment, yielding to those passions, the indulgence of which had so long rendered him a scourge to society, he had quitted his haven of rest and repentance and returned to the country where he was proscribed. The appointed punishment for his return to the land that had cast him out being death, and his case being an aggravated one, he must prepare himself to die.
Lord, I have received my sentence of death from the Almighty, but I bow to yours.
I earnestly hoped and prayed that he might die before the recorder's report was made. But that night I began to write out a petition to the Home Secretary, setting forth my knowledge of him and how it was that he had come back for my sake. I wrote as fervently and as pathetically as I could, then drew up other petitions to such men in authority as I hoped were most merciful, even to the Crown itself. For several days and nights I took no rest. Then I would roam the streets of an evening, wandering by those places where I had left the petitions, to no avail. My daily visits were shortened now, as he was strictly kept. After some 10 days, I began to see a greater change in him than I had seen yet, an absence of light in his face.
Dear boy, I thought you was late, but I know you couldn't be there.
It is just the time. I waited for it at the gate.
You've never deserted me, dear boy. And what's the best of all? You've been more comfortable along with me since I was under a dark cloud than when the sun shone. That's best of all.
He had spoken his last words. He smiled, and I understood his touch to mean that he wished me to lift my hand and lay it on his breast. I laid it there, and he smiled again and put both his hands upon it.
Dear Magwitch, I must tell you, now at last. You understand what I say?
A gentle pressure on my hand.
You had a child once, whom you loved and lost. She lived and found powerful friends. She is living now. She is a lady and very beautiful. And I love her.
With a last faint effort, he raised my hand to his lips, then let it sink gently on his breast again with his two hands lying on it, and his head dropped quietly on his breast. Although I gave notice to quit Garden Court, for I was in bad debt, the truth is I was falling very ill. The late stress had enabled me to put off illness, but not put it away. I knew it was coming on me now. I could not rise. It seemed Magwitch was coming up the stairs. I had to find the boat. Lights blew out. There was an iron furnace burning in the corner of the room.
Miss Havisham's in there!
It seemed this vapor of the lime kiln was coming between me and two men.
Well, sir, this is a matter that you'll soon arrange, I dare say, but you're arrested.
What is the debt?
£123, 15 and 6. Jewelers. You'd better come to my home. I'll keep a very nice house.
If you take me from here, I think I shall die. By the way, you see my state.
I don't know what they did, but they didn't remove me. I know I passed through fever, and I sometimes struggled with real people, thinking they were murderers. And then I would sink exhausted in their arms, knowing them to be good, and suffer them to lay me down. But above all, I know that there was a constant tendency of all these people, however extraordinarily transformed, to settle, sooner or later, into the likeness of Joe.
Is it Joe?
Would you there, old chap?
Oh, Joe. You break my heart. Look angry at me, Joe. Joe, don't be so good to me. Oh, God bless you. You gentle Christian man. How long, dear Joe, have I... Hold my hand.
Which you mean to say, Pip, how long have your illness took?
Yes, Joe.
Tomorrow was the 1st of June, Pip.
And have you been here all the time?
Pretty nigh, old chap. For as I says to Biddy when the news of your being ill were brought by letter, how you might be amongst strangers, and that how you and me having been ever the best of friends, a visit at such a moment might not prove unacceptable. Oh.
It's so good to hear you, Joe.
Biddy, her word were, go to him without loss of time. And here I am. Now, you're not to talk, so I'll write a letter to Biddy.
Joe?
Pip, old chap?
Miss Havisham. Is she dead?
She ain't living.
Have you heard what became of her property?
Well, old chap, it do appear that she had settled the most of it, which I mean to say tidied up, on Miss Estella. Well, last shovelful today. Now, old Orlick, he's been a-busting open the dwelling house.
Goose!
Whatsomever the failings on his part, he were a corn and seedsman in his heart.
Bumblechuck.
That's it, Pip. They took his till and cash box, they drinked his wine, ate his whittles, they slapped his face, pulled his nose, they tied him up to his bedpost and they gave him a dozen, they stuffed his mouth full of flour in annuals to prevent his crying out. But he knowed Orlick, and Orlick's in the county jail.
Oh, Joe, I'm better.
But as I became stronger, so Joe became less easy with me. Did he believe, this innocent, good man, I would again go cold on him and cast him off? I knew I had to tell him what I really felt. That way the change between us would be banished forever.
I feel thankful that I've been ill, Joe.
Dear old Pip, old chap. You're almost come round, sir.
It's been a memorable time for me.
Likewise for myself, sir.
We have had a time together, Joe, that I can never forget. There were days once, I know, that I did for a while forget. But I shall never forget these.
Pip, there has been larks. And dear sir, what have been betwixt us have been. You sure you is as well as this morning?
Yes, dear Joe. Quite.
Good night.
The next morning, on the breakfast table, I found his note.
Not wishful to intrude, I have departured. For you are well again, dear Pip, and will do better without. Joe. P.S. Ever the best of friends.
Enclosed in the letter was a receipt for the debt and costs on which I had been arrested. I had never dreamed Joe had paid the money, but the receipt was in his name.
Oh, Joe.
What remained but for me to follow him to the dear old forge and tell everything, and relieve my mind and heart of another growing purpose?
Biddy. Biddy, I think you once liked me very well. If you can like me only half as well, once more. No, I hope I am a little worthier of you than I was.
If you can tell me you will go through the world with me, you will surely make it a better place, and me a better man for it. And I will try hard to make it a better world for you. Biddy. Biddy. I think you once liked me very well. If you can like me only half. Early in the morning, while my breakfast was getting ready, I strolled round by Satis House. There were printed bills on the gate. The house was to be sold as old building materials and pulled down. This made it only the pleasanter to turn to Biddy and Joe. The schoolhouse where Biddy was mistress was empty. No children were there, and her house was closed. But the forge was a very short distance off, but deserted too. No clink of Joe's hammer, no glittering shower of sparks. Only the windows to the best parlour seemed to imply use, open and gay with flowers.
Pip! Oh, Pip!
Then Joe and Biddy stood before me. In another moment, she was in my embrace. We wept to see each other, she so fresh and pleasant, and me so worn and white.
Dear Biddy, how smart you are.
Yes, dear Pip.
Joe, how smart you are.
Hi, Pip.
It's my wedding day, and I am married to Joe.
Dear Biddy, you have the best husband in the whole world.
Yes.
And dear Joe, you have the best wife in the whole world, and she will make you as happy as even you deserve to be, you dear, good, noble Joe. Both of you, receive my humble thanks for all you have done for me and all I have so ill repaid. And when I say that I am going away within the hour, for I am soon going abroad, and that I shall never rest until I have worked for the money with which you have kept me out of prison and have sent it to you. Don't think, dear Joe and Biddy, that if I could repay it 1,000 times over, I suppose I could cancel a farthing of the debt I owe you, or that I would do so if I could. Pray tell me that you forgive me. I need to carry the sound of those words away with me.
Oh, dear old Pip, old chap. God knows as I forgive you, if I have anything to forgive.
Amen. And God knows I do.
I sold all I had, and within a month I went out and joined Herbert as a clerk to Clarica and Co. I must not leave it to be supposed that we were ever a great house, or that we made mints of money. We owed so much to Herbert's ever-cheerful industry and readiness that I often wondered how I had ever conceived the old idea of his ineptitude until I was one day enlightened by the reflection that perhaps the ineptitude had never been in him at all, but in me. One evening in December, some 11 years later, I lifted the latch of the old kitchen door at the forge to find Joe, a little grey in his old place, and fenced into the corner by his knee, me.
We give him the name of Pip for your sake, dear old chap, and we hoped he might grow a little bit like you. And we think he do.
Biddy, you must give Pip to me one of these days. Or lend him at all events.
No, no, you must marry.
So Herbert and Clara say. But I don't think I shall. I'm already quite an old bachelor.
Tell me, as an old friend, have you quite forgotten her?
My dear Biddy, I've forgotten nothing in my life that ever had a foremost place there. But that poor dream, as I used to call it, has all gone by, Biddy. All gone by.
I hear she's unhappy. He used her with great cruelty and lost all her money. He's dead now. He died consequent on ill-treating a horse.
After dinner, I walked through a cold, silvery mist to Satis House. The evening was not dark. I could trace out where every part of the old house had been. Then, along the desolate garden walk, came a solitary figure. Estella.
I am greatly changed. I wonder you knew me.
Do you often come back?
I have never been here since.
Nor I.
poor, poor old place. The ground belongs to me. It is the only possession I have not relinquished. Everything else has gone, little by little. But I've kept this. It was the subject of the only determined fight I made in all those wretched years. It's to be built on. I came to take leave of it. You live abroad still?
Still.
And do well, I'm sure.
I work pretty hard. Yes.
I've often thought of you. Of late, very often. There was a long, hard time when I kept far from me the remembrance of what I had thrown away when I was quite ignorant of its worth. But since my duty has not been incompatible with the admission of that remembrance, I have given it a place in my heart.
You have always held your place in my heart.
You said to me, God bless you. God forgive you. If you could say that to me then, please say it to me now. When suffering has been stronger than all other teaching and has taught me to understand what your heart used to be. Pip, I have been bent and broken, but I hope into a better shape. Be as considerate and good to me as you were, and tell me we are friends.
We are friends.
And we'll continue friends apart.
I took her hand in mine, and we went out of the ruined place. And as the morning mists had risen long ago when I first left the forge, so the evening mists were rising now. And in all the broad expanse of tranquil light they showed to me, I saw no shadow of another parting from her.